You are listening to RudolfSteinerAudio.com. If you are listening to the podcast of this, it is located at RudolfSteiner.podbean.com. Please consider becoming a patron. As well, there are two publishing houses, SteinerBooks.org in America and RudolfSteinerPress.com in England, who are the sole publishers of Steiner into English and have given me permission to do these recordings. Please consider patronizing them as well. This is a reading of Collected Works, Volume 167 by Rudolf Steiner. The book is entitled The Human Spirit, Past and Present, Occult Fraternities and the Mystery of Golgotha, 12 lectures given in Berlin, translated by Matthew Barton. This is Lecture 5, given on the 11th of April, 1916. In the grave times in which we live, whose difficulties impact on us each day with increasing force, it seems fitting to engage here in our circle in reflections which can acquaint us with the great goals of human history and the deep impulses of humanity. In our day, it is profoundly necessary to turn to great, significant revelations we can receive from the world of spirit. And this is because what we are experiencing today will most definitely lead toward times when people experience a huge need for all that can bring the human soul strength, solace, hope, and assurance from worlds of spirit. It is all the more important to cultivate such thoughts, since we are also living in a time when true spiritual deepening, that is, profound contemplation of the reality of the spiritual life that we need, is becoming endlessly difficult for humanity and encounters immeasurable obstacles. These are hindrances which, in a certain higher sense, modern people can do nothing about, encountering them simply due to the circumstances and developmental impulses of modern times that hold them back from a true engagement with a life of spirit. The latter is essential, though, and becomes more so with every passing week, and will be especially necessary in the period swiftly following ours, which in many respects will be by no means easier than the times we are living through right now. In preceding lectures, I have attempted to reflect on the connection between insights and practices cultivated in various spiritual communities and humanity's overall course of evolution. Today I would like to deepen these observations in a certain regard, although what I have to say will stand alone and quite separately from what has so far been said, and can be understood without reference to it. I will preface these thoughts, however, by reminding you that across the whole educated world, and also in less scholarly quarters, perhaps even more so there, exist certain human communities which cultivate occult knowledge. They use it, too, to inform their actions in certain ways, in their efforts to influence the course of humanity's evolution as they wish, for purposes either benevolent or not. But it is noticeable in a large majority of such communities, especially as these have been developing into modern times, that so far there is no understanding of the distinctive new need that inevitably must enter such communities. In other words, they retain the old traditions as these were passed down to them, but as yet have failed to understand what must complement and renew them, the new element that is now being revealed from the world of spirit. In a great many of these spiritual societies, therefore, that cannot as yet call themselves fully contemporary, a certain common formula predominates, a formulaic phrase which they use to refer to the creative potency pervading and pulsing through the world. When they wish to refer to these creative powers imbuing the world, to divine spiritual powers pulsing through and pervading the world. These societies speak of the, quote, sublime master builder of the world, close quote. This is a much used phrase, the sublime master builder of the world. Those who can draw on spiritual science to understand the course of human evolution will know that such a phrase, used, say, in certain Freemason societies, as well as in other occult brotherhoods, tells us that they have existed since very ancient times and are founded on very ancient institutions. It tells us that although it is not entirely wrong to see these communities originating at a later historical period, in fact they have roots that go a very long way back to earlier and different forms. That these roots go back in an unbroken line to ancient communities that existed in the fourth post-Atlantean epoch amongst the Greeks, the Romans, and also the ancient Egyptians. In fact, we can trace them still further back. The modern fraternities thus originate in these very ancient communities and are as I described them, except that in their modern form they do not have such direct communication with the world of spirit as did their forebears in the more ancient communities. Instead, they preserve the knowledge that has been passed down to them as tradition. If we wish to understand the meaning of this formulaic phrase about the sublime master builder of the world, the great architect of the universe, or why it is used, we will have to recall various matters that certainly could be known today, but have as yet not entered the common awareness of humanity, or even the more specialized knowledge of scholars. In certain modern texts by more enlightened theologians or specialists in ancient history, you can find the term, quote, primordial revelation, close quote. What does this mean? This term figures today in books that have some academic standing and are not regarded as crazy nonsense, as our books are. The term primordial revelation does appear in books, therefore, that are accorded some degree of academic respect. It is a term that we can understand particularly well if we try to familiarize ourselves with ancient religious texts. We need only look back to the writings that originate with Gautama Buddha. In such texts, in ancient religious documents, if we are open-minded enough, and not as foolish as, for instance, the person who wrote an article on conditions in ancient Egypt in the last issue of titled Zeitgeist, then we can discern that those who helped write them in long-gone millennia had a knowledge that humanity has now lost, that has gradually dried up under the weight of increasing materialism. As I said, you need only read available documents recording the utterances of Gautama Buddha, and you will see that what is written there is founded on a great knowledge, although one that even in his day had been passed down by tradition, and points back to much, much more ancient times, to a primordial knowledge, therefore. This knowledge, of course, cannot be attained in the way that knowledge is disseminated today in the academic world. I believe that an open-minded observer of modern academia will not dispute this, nor, indeed, one whose mind is closed, since such a person rejects all such knowledge and regards it as foolish and misguided. He regards it in historical terms, and will acknowledge historians who discourse upon it, as long as they cite chapter and verse in the approved academic manner, but not the knowledge itself that is studied there. He cannot admit, therefore, that such knowledge must be achieved today, since he does not accept its validity, does he? So, here we are led back to a primordial knowledge, And accordingly we must assume, as every open-minded person will on reading these ancient religious texts, that we can look back from our current time, from our glorious modern progress that includes, doesn't it, the terrible slaughter, to older periods of human evolution, to earlier centuries when people knew things that today, with their wonderful advances, they regard as a confused garble, things such as those we find in the writings of Jacob Boehme, Paracelsus, and such figures. And then we come back to the time when people did alchemical things in their retorts. Then, further and further back, when even if they were scholars, they lived according to modern views in, quote, superstitious beliefs, close quote. Back and back we go. But as we look back, with an open mind, through the Roman, Greek, and Egyptian eras, we arrive at a stage where humanity once possessed a knowledge spread across the globe in a way that is impossible today. Naturally, it is difficult for people today to grasp this, since in the time we are speaking of now, they think the human being was still only an ape, Pithecanthropus erectus, or ape-man. But despite all these theories about the ape-man, an open-minded person will, as I have said, see from ancient documents that originally a knowledge existed that is beyond the scope or reach of modern human beings, with all their cleverness. An endlessly profound knowledge encompassing worlds of spirit to an outstanding degree. He will see that this knowledge contains not only an awareness of the human capacity to rise into worlds of spirit, but of the possibility, too, of finding there other beings not incarnated in the flesh. These are the beings we refer to today as the ranks of the angeloi, archangeloi, and so on. In these primordial religious texts, we even discover that people speak of these higher spirit beings as ones with whom they communicated. This can be demonstrated in these texts themselves. What is the underlying basis of this? Well, from a certain perspective, made possible by a particular stage of initiation, we can grasp the reasons for this secret. But even at a lesser degree of initiation, one very commonplace and easily attained, we can understand what underlies it simply by means of an analogy. We know, of course, that besides what sensory evidence tells us of the world around us, there is another underlying aspect, that of the so-called elemental world. We can only speak of this, describe it, by resorting to ancient mythology and using its terms to identify various types of elemental beings, the gnomes that underlie the mineral realm, the undines in the watery and plant realm, the sylphs in the enlivened atmosphere, and the salamander beings at work in the whole earthly domain. To speak seriously of such things in any other than this present enlightened circle can engender a sense of reticence, even shame. But today amongst ourselves we can do so. Thus the natural world surrounding us is founded on elemental beings. But we should not imagine that these beings are simply there so that people who become clairvoyant can perceive them, and that they serve no purpose otherwise, and the rest of the time simply rest lazily on their laurels. That is certainly not true. These beings have their good mission in the world and have a great deal to do. They take care of things that external materialistic science thinks take care of themselves. But they don't take care of themselves. Anyone whose eyes are open for the beings of this elemental world will see that really they have to pass through an annual cycle, and that the influence upon these beings that descends from worlds of spirit varies from spring through summer, autumn and winter, the elemental realm of these beings, therefore surrounds us and underpins the kingdom of nature, and powers stream down to them, almost a kind of instruction, so that in spring they acquire the capacity to draw forth the earth's plant cover. Certain spirit beings bear downward the powers of the spirits of form, conveying them to these elemental beings so that a new world of forms sprout and burgeon in spring. As summer approaches, they receive a subsequent influx and can thus accomplish what occurs toward summer. During the course of the year, therefore, changes occur in the nature of the mutual interplay between the spirits of the higher hierarchies and the elemental beings that live and weave in the natural world surrounding us. There is a continual upward and downward streaming of spirit beings of the higher hierarchies whose, in quotes, pupils are the elemental beings who must deliver the enlivening powers for all that shoots, sprouts, arises, and fades again. Things do not merely grow forth from the earth, but are also in direct interplay with the heavenly spiritual realm. And those who think that the plants and creatures that reawaken each spring do so only by emerging from earthly forces can be compared, say, to worms who, living below ground and never rising to the surface, must think as they crawl from plant root to plant root that roots are all that exist, that the world of leaves and flowers above is a fantasy. Then, when one day such a worm does poke its head out and sees that from the roots emerge leaves and blossoms above, reaching up toward sunlight, and comes back to tell the other worms below about this, they will say, no doubt, that he is a crazy worm with distorted ideas, and that what he is describing cannot possibly exist. Well, this is probably not true of worms, for they are likely to be brighter than that. But something similar is true of human beings. Thus, as I said, what sprouts during the year is in direct interplay with the beings whose powers stream upward and downward and pour these into the elemental world. Yet in the same way, my friends, that sylphs, gnomes, undines, and salamanders receive influences from these beings of the higher hierarchies that rise and descend depending on the time of year, so the human being, when he was not as yet so closely bound up with his physical body, received instruction from the rising and sinking spirits of the higher hierarchies. And all the myths and legends that have come down to us and tell us that in ancient times the human being enjoyed instruction from such beings descending from worlds of spirit are based on truth. The human being himself was one amongst the spirits accounted for today only by gnomes, sylphs, undines, and so forth. These elemental spirits receive the powers by means of which they develop forms that sprout from the earth and fade again through the seasons. And similarly, in ancient times, the human being received instruction from the rising and sinking spirits of the higher hierarchies. The last vestiges of what he thus received in primordial days has been preserved for us in the extant texts that have come down to us, in which an open-minded person can discern the nature of this primordial revelation. This primordial revelation existed, and in the eras preceding the 8th century BC, the last vestiges of this primordial revelation flowed down to humanity. We can be fairly precise here. Around the year 747 BC, the further evolution of human physical nature excluded us from immediate participation in such instruction, though naturally these things phase in gradually. All the ancient knowledge flowed into human beings through the direct instruction of spiritual beings. And these primordial disciplines, though no longer understood, reached humankind by this means and are recorded in extant texts. The last field of knowledge that reached humankind in this way is one we will now consider. What did human beings learn as time passed, from the original period of ancient Atlantis onward, when such primordial revelation flowed down to them? They learned of the connection they themselves had, as human beings, with the worlds of spirit. You see, the human being is a microcosm in whom unfold in miniature all the powers and processes at work in the greater world. The last thing humankind learned in this way, by influx from without, was geometry and arithmetic. And anyone today who still allows geometry and arithmetic in the true sense to work upon him will have a sense that something approaches him in this domain that is different from other knowledge. We gather other knowledge from experience, compile it. But in geometry and arithmetic, we can feel a sense of its truth quite apart from all outward experience, sensory experience. No one can prove that a triangle's angles add up to 180 degrees simply by drawing one or reproducing it from sensory experience. This can only be proven through an inner thought experience. And likewise, no one can prove that 3 times 3 are 9 merely by outward counting, but only through inner picturing and thinking. You don't need to have beans or peas to count with, nor your fingers. You need only inwardly conceive this, and thereby arrive at the truth that 3 times 3 are 9. But in its further scope, the thinking that underlies geometry and arithmetic comes to expression in architectural forms. In Egyptian times, people referred back to an older primordial knowledge in which geometry and arithmetic were revealed. In Greco-Roman times, ancient knowledge was conveyed to people in the mysteries in the following way. By entering into profound contemplation, they were told, "You can bring forth from you what was revealed by the spirits of the higher hierarchies when you lived on earth in earlier times." This was not necessary in the Egyptian mysteries, since these high beings still themselves descended. In Greco-Roman times, a master would gather his pupils round him and tell them that in former incarnations they had passed through a phase of human evolution in which the spirits of the higher hierarchies participated. This reality became embedded in their souls, and they could, they were told, draw upon it and bring it into awareness. Such a master in the Greek and Roman mysteries had his pupils draw up what lay in the human soul. You see, everything can be found in the human soul, since it all streamed down from spirits to human beings through the primordial revelation. What we draw forth from us today, really draw forth from within us, is something that we once underwent in the form of instruction from the higher hierarchies. Then came the year 1413, 1414, and since the materialistic age properly began at that point, human beings could no longer be aware of what is actually within them as legacy from their former spiritual instruction. From then on, the soul's close union with the physical body covered and concealed what there is in our souls. But in the whole period, from 747 BC to AD 1413, it was possible to draw forth from the soul, raise from it, what had once streamed into it in earlier times, as I described. Just think how someone must have felt in the olden times, especially in ancient Greece. He would have said that the geometry, coming to expression in the forms of a building, once flowed down in divine spiritual instruction from without. This geometry was embodied in forms, and the human being was surrounded and encompassed by such forms. But when a person wishes to draw a triangle today, he takes a piece of chalk and draws it. The ancient Greek had no need of this as yet. He needed only to reflect on the form, and could then see it before him as if clairvoyantly, in etheric clairvoyance. He could draw the geometry in his inner clairvoyant perception. This is how it was in still older times, primordial times, with written script. One did not need to merely write on a papyrus, but could also write things before one's inner vision, clairvoyantly. But as I said, people placed around them what flowed into architectural forms. At a certain period of the Greek mysteries, people were taught the following, quote, "Reflect clearly upon yourself, and if you reflect upon the divine human being living within you, and therefore do not only consider your transient earthly human being, there will arise around you an edifice created from the forms of geometry, with you at its center." Close quote. As the spider spins its web around itself, so a pupil of the Greek mysteries span etherically around himself a whole geometrical configuration, in which the rest of human knowledge then found its place for him. He then needed only create this around himself outwardly, in the form of the Greek temple. The Greek temple is nothing other than the geometrical forms arising clairvoyantly around the human being and then filled with physical material. The Greek temple adds only the stones to these configurations. And this is why the ancient Greek always also tended to place a statue of the god inside the temple, representing in a sense his own divine human nature within it. Thus, in the times when this was done, he did not only erect a temple, but within it also a divine image, Pallas Athena or some other god, since these things belonged together. The surrounding macrocosm, together with what emerges from and manifests out of the cosmos, but must now, of course, reveal itself from within for the reasons described. Thus we see here a connection between the building of the temple and an original clairvoyance. Those who erected buildings in these times therefore saw something divine in the art of building, something that was most intimately connected with all inner human revelations. They did not build as we do today, having learned a profession at university or college, mastered all the required skills, and then practicing the craft, but they had a quite different feeling about how to go about building. That is why people today look so askance today on our efforts to found what we are building here in Dornach on our own spiritual science. They would think it right if an ordinary building company built it, an architect who, in their view, would not need to know the least thing about our spiritual science. People no longer know that the purpose served by the building must come to expression in the whole outer surroundings and edifice. In times when people experienced a building as the revelation of the spirits of form, they did know this. This is why Vitruvius, a great architect at the time of Augustus, speaks in such a remarkable way of the builder and his art. He speaks of the moral qualities a builder must possess, his sense of the divine meaning of the universe. I would like to read you a striking passage from Vitruvius, where he says the following about an architect or builder. Quote, "He must therefore not only possess natural talents, but also an eagerness to learn. For neither genius without academic education, nor academic education without genius, can make a perfect artist. He must have skill in writing, be experienced in draftsmanship, knowledgeable of geometry, not unknowledgeable in optics, and well instructed in arithmetic. He must know many stories, have attended conscientiously to philosophy, understand music, have knowledge of medicine, be familiar with law and acquainted with star lore, together with the course of the planetary bodies. Close quote. Why, in Vitruvius's view, should the architect and builder know all these things? It is because the forms of a building are the revelations of higher hierarchies. People in those times were aware that the real architects were the beings of the higher hierarchies. This is of huge importance. And what feeling did such a builder have? A modern architect would make a long face, wouldn't he, if he were required not only to know what is taught about his profession at college or university, but in addition to this, medicine, philosophy, and even astronomy and the movements of stars and planets. In a sense, therefore, he would have to be someone initiated into the spiritual sciences. Why was this so? Vitruvius himself still felt that when he created a building, this must not arise from himself as a finite human being, but this finite being must become the instrument of a being of the higher hierarchies working through him. It was, however, only in the occult mysteries that people acquired the means to enter into connection with the higher hierarchies, in such a way that when stone was laid on stone to create a building, the spirits of the higher hierarchies worked through a finite human being. One had to be initiated into the connection between the divine and human worlds. It was necessary to know about medicine because the forms of a building should be configured so as to make them a real expression or reflection of the human being, comparable, in a sense, to the way a snail shell reflects the nature of the snail, constructed out of the macrocosm in correspondence with the inner nature informing it. Thus, a human being felt that this divine spiritual nature was at work in him, that it guided his hands and governed his mind to work into the forms that architecture created. It is because the forms of architecture were the last revelation given that everything living in the occult societies I spoke of last time emerged from this true architecture and the mood of the builder in the practice of his craft and profession. Albeit in distorted caricature form, these occult societies preserve a sense, above all, that someone admitted to them enters upon a path into worlds of spirit. At the second grade or degree, he establishes with the other members of his occult community relationships that are not governed solely by outer social circumstances, are not determined by these, but arise purely from soul to soul. At this second level, he becomes a friend, companion, or confrère, and he learns to feel, finally, what it means to stand here as a human being and feel himself to contain or encompass what lives in him as spirit being, with whom the beings of the higher hierarchy speak, to whom they incline themselves. Someone who may speak no word that is not inspired by these spirits of the higher hierarchies. It is true, however, that there is little awareness of this today in those who reach the third degree of such occult societies and then call themselves masters of the third degree. And yet this reality underpins such societies. And because revelations are no longer forthcoming, because no such intensive influence is experienced, since there is no longer any direct connection with the world of spirit, people rely instead on tradition, on what is passed down. They spread a veil of secrecy over this, forbid others to partake of it, keep this knowledge hidden. Yet an original knowledge is preserved in such communities, passed down through the centuries from generation to generation, although frequently distorted and misused, wrongfully influencing humanity as I described last time. The fourth post-Atlantean period, ending in the 15th century around 1413, existed so as to gradually allow our direct connection with the world of spirit to dry up and disappear. But the remarkable thing is that finer, more sensitive minds continue to feel their former connection with the spiritual world, even at a time when this had faded and vanished. During the whole period from 747 BC to AD 1413, a certain connection with the world of spirit still existed, as I have suggested. At least it was possible for people to enliven this connection inwardly during this period, enliven it through memory, at least. But in the 14th century, this came to an end. But beyond the 14th century, sensitive minds still felt that the spirit plays into human life. Students of history today, as I have often said, are taught that human nature has always been more or less what it now is in our age of, quote, glorious advancement, close quote. But this is not so. If you wish to understand the 15th, 16th, and 17th centuries, you first have to develop some sense that these were times when a last breath of spiritual life still encompassed the earth. And in older eras, a person felt his surroundings to be composed not only of plants, clouds, winds, storms, and lightning, but also of elemental beings that were no less real to him than plants, creatures, and so forth. But this awareness faded and disappeared, naturally, not all at once. So that from the 14th century and on into the 17th, more sensitive people knew that the spirit lived and was active around them. In those times, people did not yet regard an influx from the world of spirit as they do today. Today, it is called hysteria. Yes, hysteria. And yet this tells us nothing. It may manifest in an hysterical form, certainly. But the world of spirit may still be playing into behavior described as hysterical. These two things have nothing to do with each other. Today, people accept merely materialistic interpretations. But in the times I have spoken of, they still knew a thing or two, and did not regard an influx from the world of spirit into human life as merely pathological. Although it can also be so in our materialistic sense. If we do not grasp this, we cannot comprehend certain things at all. A modern historian may speak, say, of the period of Savonarola in the 15th century, and in doing so will often speak of Florence at that time, as if he were talking about a modern city. We'll speak of it as if he were describing the way people nowadays congregate outside grocery shops and chat to each other. No thought is given to the fact that one must first transpose oneself back, imagine oneself back into the mood of that time, a mood in which people still felt something of spiritual reality. Let us ask what it was in a certain week in Florence that made people on the street walk about as if deeply troubled and burdened. It was because Savonarola had told them the previous Sunday that if their moral conduct continued as it was, another flood would inundate them all. He concluded his sermon with these words, I'm going to give it a try in Latin, Ecce ego aducam aquas super terram. I tell you that the waters will flood the earth. And spirit enlivened these words, streaming forth from them. and the inhabitants of Florence felt the spiritual influence of these words for a week, and walked about the streets as I have described. One of Savonarola's contemporaries was Pico della Mirandola, Count Mirandola. He lived at the end of the 15th century and was wholly immersed in this mood that spread over Florence at the time. This was the time of transition between the 4th and 5th post-Atlantean epochs. Pico della Mirandola was one of those sensitive minds I spoke of. They felt the spirit was fading from the world around, and at the same time they experienced an inmost longing to feel it still, to seek its entry into them. Yes, there were a whole number of people in Florence at that time who lived in this mood. They felt that the spirit was vanishing from ordinary human life, but that they must bring it back into them. These Renaissance people called themselves Neoplatonists, and no one could enter their academy unless he had had some experience testifying to his soul's connection with and direct vision of the spirit living and active around us. This was in the 15th century still. One could not enter the Florence Academy, which cultivated Neoplatonism, the revival of Plato, if one did not first endeavor to have an experience that gave one direct knowledge that the spirit works into sensory life. Pico had several such moments, and therefore he understood the words of Savonarola, which, albeit in an idiosyncratic way, were imbued with such spiritual insights. In his own way, Pico understood Savonarola, but was too vain to engage with what Savonarola wished for him, to become his close ally and comrade. Pico della Mirandola could not reconcile such a thing with his vanity. And when he drew near to death, still as a relatively young man, he had another such experience. As he saw his end approaching, and he was still very young, he was able to look into the world of spirit. In such an experience, the forms in which the beings of the world of spirit are configured are oriented to a person's subjective perception. The spiritual world revealed itself to Pico clothed in the image of the Madonna. In brief, the Madonna appeared to him, we can say, and spoke thus to him, quote, "I will not deliver you wholly up to death," close quote. Mirandola did not immediately understand what this meant. He thought it meant he could go on living as a physical person. But he died, and Savonarola himself held the funeral oration. And it is important that we can transpose ourselves into the whole mood at this transition between the 4th and 5th post-Atlantean epochs. It may be helpful for us to remind ourselves of the words spoken by Savonarola at the grave of Pico della Mirandola. For we find in these words a recognition of the importance of such a person's relationship with the world of spirit, revealed to him in this way in an image before he died. Standing at the grave of Pico della Mirandola, Savonarola spoke the following words, and we can see them at the same time as evidence of the fact that funeral orations in those days were not mere flattery, but truthful occasions. Quote, "None amongst you did not know Giovanni Pico. God magnanimously endowed him with great deeds of benevolence and lofty favors. His knowledge was manifold, and his spirit towered over mortals. For the church, too, his death signifies a great loss. If he had not lived so briefly, it is my firm conviction that he would have outshone all scholars of the last 8 centuries. A divine voice in his heart called him to take holy orders, and he was at first willing to follow this call. But he continually postponed his entry to the cloisters, whether through ingratitude toward God, or because a sensual nature held him back from this, or because he was anxious at the thought of the hardships of a monastic life due to the frailty of his body, or, finally, because he felt himself already to be serving religion through his scholarly works. For this reason I have been threatening him for the past 2 years with the divine scourge, and I here acknowledge that I called upon the Highest to discipline him a little for his omissions. But God, nevertheless, showed him lenience. While the soul of the deceased has not yet entered upon the bliss of heaven, in the lap of the Father, yet it is not condemned eternally, either to the martyrdom of hell. For a certain period it will make its atonement in the fires of purgatory. What I tell you of Pico's death is not refuted by the promise made to him by the sacred Madonna. At first I thought this promise to be the machinations of a demon. Close quote, Steiner again, here Savonarola is speaking of Pico della Mirandola's last vision. Continue quote, but then it became clear to me that the dying man, in the sensory confusions of his last hour, thought that this promise was of the first death, but that the Madonna was speaking, in fact, of eternal death. Close quote. In other words, according to Savonarola, the Madonna was saying he would not suffer eternal punishment, but would be chastised only for a short period after death. I merely wished to characterize the kind of mood voiced on such occasions in relation to spiritual matters. This is a good example, for Savonarola is not someone who would have invoked spiritual matters hypocritically, simply in his role as a priest. He was a man of whom we can be assured that he followed the voice only of his personal conviction in every situation and circumstance. He did not speak only to please the Church, which in fact did not regard him kindly, and treated him accordingly, but he spoke of the world of spirit from his own experience. What Savonarola received as direct revelations from the world of spirit naturally far surpassed the knowledge of it that Pico possessed. I wished only to describe this to you because it is important to consider the mood people had toward the world of spirit, if we are to understand this sudden, swift transition from the 14th to the 15th century. What we have heard can strike us as a longing to return to the time when people still more easily received impressions of the world of spirit. But now these people were isolated and more lonely. They had to undertake special ascetic exercises to acquire what they desired, at least at certain moments in life, perhaps even in a distorted form. It really is not true to say, as modern scholars do, that everything developed so slowly and gradually. Nature takes no sudden leaps, it is said, but that is the stupidest idea. It takes no leaps as such, but continually one finds metamorphoses or transitions, incisive ones. The green sepal does not slowly transform into something a little less sepal-like, and then a little less sepal-like again into a colored petal. But the plant passes from one to the other without any intermediate stage. It is nonsense to say nature makes no leaps. But such phrases are bandied around without thinking. The next mission in humanity's development was to invoke the powers that must replace an old capacity to absorb the spirit. Ordinarily, there were two means to do this. One was simply to perpetuate tradition. People were content with what the ancients had perceived and revealed and perpetuated it by means of tradition, and this gave rise to many secret societies. But there were also people who endeavored to draw upon the new power of soul that had emerged. They sought to translate what had previously existed in a quite different form, as picture and direct vision, into the form of rational thought bound up with the body. This capacity to reason that we now have as ordinary people in the fifth post-Atlantean epoch. The great Amos Comenius was one of those who now sought to raise into a proper contemporary context the former building principle, although, of course, conceived of in a quite different way, in pictures and symbols. I do not think many people know anything much about Amos Comenius anymore. He was really the founder of our whole modern schooling system, and he established reading primers. Living in the 16th century, our whole approach to teaching children originated with him, It may be of interest to read you a few excerpts relating to this, because there is so little awareness today of Amos Comenius. Amongst the various books and anthologies that have been published, not all of which are good, is one entitled Comenius and the Bohemian Brotherhood by Friedrich Eckstein. Eckstein was a colleague of mine in Vienna at the end of the 1880s, and together we were part of a theosophical group. Later he went his own way, and I heard nothing from him for a long time. And now this little book by him about Amos Comenius has been published, a very useful compilation. Eckstein says of the so-called Orbis Pictus that, quote, its primitive illustrations, albeit in modern, mutilated, and truncated editions, gave all of us pleasure in our youth. In the 150 woodcuts of the original edition, with their brief text in German and Latin, entirely in keeping with the principle of teaching simultaneously through tangible and verbal means, the chief concepts and principles of life were conveyed to the child's mind, beginning with God, the world, the heavens, and the elements, plants, fruits, animals, the human body and its limbs, through to the various forms of work and craft, and this with a moving, heartwarming simplicity and clarity of words and pictures. Looking at it, we can immediately understand why this book made such a deep impression on the children of many generations. Herder and Goethe loved it more than anything in their childhood, and no doubt drew from it impulses that accompanied them through their lives. Subquote, at the time there were as yet no libraries for children, close subquote, writes Goethe in his first book of title Poetry and Truth. And he continues, subquote, the ancients themselves still had a childlike outlook and found it easy to convey their own culture to future generations. Apart from the Orbis Pictus by Amos Comenius, no book of this kind fell into our hands. Close subquote, close quote. Steiner again. The whole way of creating children's books, that is, school books for children, was based on Amos Comenius. But Comenius was a man born in Moravia who formed connections in the course of his life with numerous secret fraternities throughout Europe, similar to the ones I have described. They existed everywhere, you see. And he formed real connections with all of them and tried to influence them all. What he writes in his title Pan Sophia especially shows how he did so effectively. Here, therefore, in Amos Comenius, in the 16th and 17th centuries, at the beginning of our era, we find a person who knew that change was afoot, that a new different age was dawning, and that what formerly existed must now be recreated in the form of outer reason, rather than being preserved and perpetuated as tradition. Tradition was founded on the last revelations to be received, on temple building, irrespective of whether this concerned the Greek temple or that of Solomon. The nature of temple building, symbolic, imaginative pictures concerned with temple building, were the foundation of everything else. In his title Pan Sophia, Amos Comenius set about transforming everything into a mode corresponding to the soul nature of the fifth post-Atlantean epoch. He writes, quote, we chose the name Pan Sophia because we wished to give a stimulus to all people to perceive everything and in general to be wise, to fill the mind with the truth of things rather than with the smoke of opinions. One might also call this the science of the best, of the select, or even the science of unknowledge, if we wish to recall Socrates or the Apostle. But why should the temple of Pan Sophia be erected according to the ideas, standards, and laws of the greatest master builder himself? Here Amos Comenius is addressing the, quote, sublime master builder of worlds, close quote, invoked in a true knowledge of the art of building in ancient times. We should take this quite literally, although in a spiritual sense. But Amos Comenius now seeks to translate this into the language of the fifth post-Atlantean epoch. Listen to how he does so. Quote, But why should the temple of Pan Sophia be erected according to the ideas, standards, and laws of the greatest master builder himself? Because we follow the archetype of the whole according to measure, number, position, and purpose of its parts, in the way that God's wisdom itself ordains. And as we first see in Exodus, when the tabernacle was erected, then in the book of Solomon, when the temple was constructed, and finally in Ezekiel, when the temple was rebuilt. Close quote, Steiner again. He could equally well have referred to the Greek temple. Continue, quote, "If we wish to erect the temple of wisdom, we must always remember that the temple to be built was great, glorious, and praiseworthy throughout all lands, because our God is higher than all other gods. Worthy and industrious builders must therefore be called upon wherever they can be found, so that they may discover and create what is needed. The Temple of Solomon was built upon Mount Moriah at God's command." Moriah means, subquote, "the countenance of God," close subquote, close quote. Steiner again. "And in the same way, the human being was built out of the lap of the Godhead. So, as we have seen, Vitruvius required a builder to possess in his mind all wisdom about the human being. Quote, "The foundation of the temple of wisdom will thus be a countenance of God," close quote. And in the same way, the countenance of God, which means the revelation of God, should be revealed through the new form of knowledge. Quote, "That is, the invisible grand master of the world, in his omnipotence, wisdom, and goodness, should be perceived by the human spirit as working through all that is visible. The building materials of the Temple of Solomon were stones, marble, and precious stones, and sappy and aromatic woods, firs and cedars, and the purest metal and gold. Three forests supply the wood for building the Temple of Wisdom." Close quote, Steiner again, and now he translates this. Continue, quote, "In other words, the senses, reason, and divine revelation. The first supplies what can be grasped, the second what lives, and the third what is intransient and eternal." Close quote, Steiner again. Formerly, this was embodied in the images of stone, wood, and the gold inlay. But now he translates this into the language of the fifth post-Atlantean epoch. The first supplies what can be held and grasped, the senses. Reason supplies the living element, and revelation supplies the intransient and eternal. Here you have the translation. And then he goes on, quote, "Of the stones walls were built, of wood the carved reliefs, and of gold were made the sheets to adorn the reliefs and the marble tiling, and then also the sacred vessels and tools. And thus the walls of the Temple of Wisdom are raised from sensory certainty." Close quote, Steiner again. In other words, what the senses give us forms the walls of our Temple of Wisdom. Continue, quote, "While the reliefs, the wood, give us our reasoned conclusions, what we add to the senses. And the gold inlaid upon it arises from the harmony of perception with revelation. The Temple of Solomon arose from perfectly dressed stones, and during the construction no sound was heard of hammer, axe, or iron tool. In the same way, when building the Temple of Wisdom, there should be no altercation or dispute, but all must be undertaken in perfect proportion, so that it need only be placed together. Wisdom must have already been discussed and concluded in advance, and have been elaborated in all things," close quote, Steiner again. "No altercation and dispute in the search for wisdom. That is why, my dear friends, we should seek in our society for a spiritual wisdom dependent on absence of quarrel and dispute between members. If our aim is to be achieved, quarrel and dispute must be excluded from our ranks. Especially recent times have shown, as you know, the degree to which this golden rule is adhered to." Then Amos Comenius continues, quote, The parts of the Temple of Solomon were in the finest and most perfect relationship of number and measure. And an angel with a measuring cord, etc., made the ground plan. Close quote, Steiner again. Here you have again a reference to the Angelos. Continue quote. In the same way, in the Temple of Wisdom too, all should be well measured, so that the spirit is preserved from all error and deviation. In the Temple of Solomon there were adornments, carvings, embossed work, cherubim, palms, and flowers. In the Temple of Wisdom, beauty, fine representation, should be the adornment. Everything encompassed within the Temple of Solomon was sacred. So too must it be with the Temple of Wisdom. Its contents should be pure and sacred, dedicated to the highest goals. But what God once promised to the builders of the Temple of Jerusalem, his presence, his help, his blessing, can also be expected by those who build the Temple of Wisdom. For he says, I love those who love me, etc., and load them with treasures. Finally, when the foundation for the walls was laid in that Temple of Solomon, the Levites and the priests and their adornments stood there and praised God with cymbals and flutes, together with the people. Close quote. As you know, things are done similarly in our day. Here spiritual wisdom is sought, as worlds of spirit reveal it. And the priests of all confessions, as you know, stand outside with the people and praise what is found with cymbals and flutes. I am sure you have seen this being done by the priests and scholars of our day. Quote, thus when the Temple of Wisdom is erected, all devout people should gather together and praise the name of the Lord from now to eternity, from the rising of the sun to its setting. We desire a school of wisdom, universal wisdom, a pan-Sophian or all-wisdom school, that is, a workshop where all are admitted to be schooled, receiving practice in all that is necessary for life, both as it is today and in the future, in a fully comprehensive fashion. And this should happen by such certain means that there would be no one there who knew nothing of these things and was unable to make the necessary use of this understanding. Close quote. Steiner again. We can say that what Goethe portrays in title Wilhelm Meister, especially in title The Journeyman Years, and what he seeks to make of the human being there, is a continuation of what Amos Comenius wished. And then, in turn, without being immodest, but looking objectively at the goal of our endeavors, we can see how a beginning was made in the 16th and 17th centuries of what we can now take up and further in our own efforts for humanity's evolution. Then what we seek will be very much the right thing, not what arises from subjective capriciousness, but what the evolution of humanity requires and necessitates. We can see things like this, and I have often expressed it. Modern science is working from one direction, and spiritual science from the other. And they must meet in the middle to produce the whole truth. Science and spiritual science do not contradict each other. Like tunnel builders working from two directions toward each other, who meet in the middle if everything, the levels and angles and so on, has been calculated correctly, so modern science and spiritual science, if it proceeds in an authentic and honest way, will meet each other. And they can and will do so. There is already evidence of this today, and I would like to speak of this now. I could offer a great deal of evidence for it, but I will only mention the following by way of conclusion. Just the other day, a book by Carl Ludwig Schleich was published, one based on modern scientific inquiry, entitled The Mechanism of Thoughts. It is an extremely interesting book by an honest researcher and physician, who endeavors to draw on everything afforded him by the whole scope of sense-based knowledge. The book also contains a very remarkable chapter that is bound to mark a new departure in our time. But we can see how, working from one direction, it must meet what spiritual science is bringing toward it from the other. This chapter is entitled Hysteria, a Metaphysical Problem. Here, the author describes a series of curious cases of hysteria. Let me just read a couple to you. Quote, "An hysterical young lady sits on her sofa. An electrically powered fan stands in a corner of the room on a small table. To the physician who visits her, she says in terrible anxiety, in a really hysterical manner, subquote, "My God, that's humming so loudly. It sounds like a huge bee." Close subquote. Remember, this is a fan. Subquote, "Well, miss," I said, "if it were a bee, we would chase it out of the window." Close subquote. Subquote, "No, no, it might sting me. Oh, God, what if it stung me in the eye?" Close subquote. Well, I tried to calm her by saying that even that would not be fatal and could be cured. The poor lady's lower eyelid started swelling up as she continued to lament her plight, forming a clearly inflamed and very painful edema, the size of a hen's egg, of doughy consistency. Close quote. Steiner again. In other words, the thought that a huge bee is present in the room was enough to give rise to a real lump on her lower eyelid, as large as a hen's egg. Other anecdotes recorded here may be less suitable to read out, but I would like to read another interesting case that is in fact very significant, and originates, as the author says, from very recent clinical experience at a military hospital. Quote, "A corporal, dark as an Italian, with burning dark eyes and a wild and not easily controlled temperament, came to us with both elbow joints shot through and suffering severe ulceration to the wounds. We succeeded in assuaging the condition. In other words, the fever abated, and he regained enough movement in the upper arm stumps to enable him to play the mouth harmonica again, the favorite instrument of our soldiers. But then another soldier was admitted and placed in the bed opposite him, suffering from a head wound, feverish and half unconscious, with intermittent convulsions. As a possible operation was being discussed, someone unwisely said out loud, 'It might be tetanus.' It was not tetanus, in fact. A piece of the skull was removed and the patient recovered, but in the meantime, on the third day after the man with the head wound had been admitted, our corporal, with the now almost healed upper arm wounds, did suddenly contract tetanus 4 months after he had been admitted." Close quote. Steiner again. In other words, this happened simply because he heard the word tetanus. He had been in the ward for 4 months, and so any infection must be excluded, especially since the other man did not even have tetanus. Quote, "All symptoms of the condition were present, except that he had no fever. We injected antitoxin into the spine without success. I was very perplexed by the state of the patient. We undertook the normal, absolutely reliable test for tetanus by injecting a rabbit with the blood serum from the patient's vertebral canal, and the results were negative. No tetanus bacilli were discovered. After a few days, a cure was effected by stating categorically to the patient, 'This is not tetanus.' In other words, the case was an hysterical attack of tetanus," in quotes, close quote. Steiner again. In other words, he did not have tetanus at all in physical terms. Then Professor Schleich continues, quote, "And now let me present a few experiences that demonstrate how hysteria can lead very near to a final curtailment of life. There are cases of apparent death due to hysteria, which Arndt also refers to. Other authors have reliably recorded such cases, although I myself have not witnessed them." Close quote. Steiner again. I expressly emphasize here that such cases are very well known to spiritual science and are by no means to be considered anything out of the ordinary, although they do surprise modern physicians. But here now is a very remarkable case. Quote, "A very wealthy businessman who ran his office in person came to me one day and begged me to amputate his arm, as he had stabbed his fingers with his pen and now knew that he would otherwise die of blood poisoning. I would have laughed, except that fear was written all over the man's face and stifled all mockery. He had already consulted several excellent surgeons, even Bergmann, who had all refused to amputate his arm. He said I should take pity on him and take off his upper arm, which was already tingling and itching. Naturally, I too had to send him away after all attempts to reassure him. I went to see him the same evening. No raised temperature, no sign of swelling or inflammation around the wound, which I had cleaned, bandaged, and even sucked out. But he was still very agitated. Subquote, "Why will no one amputate it? I could be saved." Close subquote. The next day, the man was dead. My friend Langerhans carried out the post-mortem examination. No infection, no toxins in the blood, no cause of death whatsoever. My diagnosis was death by hysteria. Close quote. Steiner again. And so we see that, as Schleich fully acknowledges, thoughts can not only cause a swollen eyelid and so on, but even death. That is the power of thought. And this induces a modern physician who is honest in his research, as in this case, to say that in the first case, that of swollen tissue caused by an hysterical impulse, we see the metaphysical problem of incarnation. A thought incarnates itself, becomes flesh as the soul embodies itself when it descends from worlds of spirit and kindles the whole organism. In other words, the modern physician here comes a very great way toward us, speaks of incarnation. And in the second case, he refers to mediumistic perception, a kind of clairvoyant vision of possible illnesses. The honest modern scientist must indeed speak of clairvoyance and incarnation if he wishes to reflect on his actual clinical experiences. You see, it is not capricious and vacuous to say that science and spiritual science must work toward each other from two directions. They will meet each other in the Word. I say this not arbitrarily or with some kind of fanatical impulse, but out of an awareness of the needs of our time. Naturally, though, further inquiry is needed here, for it is easily seen that an ordinary thought cannot, of course, engender a swelling. Try it yourself. However hard you try, you cannot think a lump into appearing. Thank God you can't. Thank God an ordinary thought cannot do this, and will not kill you either. You can be reassured on that score. There are mysteries underlying all such cases. But above all, one thing in particular underlies them, which we can never discern as long as we remain with the ordinary I and the ordinary content of our thoughts. Capital I, what occurred in the case of a hysterical lady whose lower eyelid swelled up. Her thought, in response to the electric fan, became a vivid image for her, an imagination, and furled down to the astral body. From there, incarnating through the etheric body into the physical body. We must be clear about this. The case cannot be explained without going beyond our ordinary ideas of the ego and seeing how this works down into the astral, etheric, and physical body. The capital I formed thought alone did not kill the businessman either. But what lived in this I thought penetrated down into the astral body, which is in direct connection with the powers of life and death. In other words, to explain such cases, we must first discover what spiritual science can offer science from the other direction. Sadly, we often speak in words that do not engage with each other. We meet in facts and realities, but our words are often ships that pass in the night, and it would be good if this were no longer so. To say that we do not meet in words is certainly not meant as a criticism of this excellent book, which might really mark a new departure in research, also from the perspective I suggested. It is probably more worthwhile to highlight this failure to connect in words in relation to a thoroughly honest researcher than in instances where there may be some doubt about this. You see, Schleich speaks in the preceding section of this book about the, quote, myth of brain metabolism, close quote. For him, metabolism in the brain is just a myth. That is a very finely put and innovative. But now he goes on to say that Goethe already knew that the skull, the bones of the skull, are transformed vertebra. Of course, this is widely known. But he states that we can explore this further. Again, Schleich is to be greatly commended for realizing that we can pursue this idea further and see the whole skull, in fact, as transformed ganglion, transformed parts of the spinal column. And then Schleich says that Goethe was really a visionary in his own way, and that he might also have been able to come up with this idea that not only the skull bones are transformed vertebra, but that the whole brain itself is a metamorphosis. Schleich concludes his chapter on the myth of brain metabolism very beautifully by saying, quote, if Goethe, this visionary and prophet, was able to discern so many connections in the divinity of nature, and could show that the skull, with all its plates, is nothing other than an unfurled cervical vertebra, and that all constituents of the latter can be detected in the brain's bony capsule, I would be most surprised if he had not also conceived in the labyrinth of his thoughts the idea we have just expressed of the subquote configuring of the brain from the elements of the spine, close subquote, continue quote. I would not be surprised if some page of Goethe's notes about this should surface. For to what purpose would the vertebra have sought to arch upward, as if on swan's wings, if not to receive, cover, and protect the rising dome of that central organ? Close quote. Steiner again. In 1916, therefore, Schleich says he would not be at all surprised if some note by Goethe should be found suggesting this. Actually, I discovered such a note in 1892 in the Goethe and Schiller archive, and have repeatedly publicized this whole idea, which Schleich now reproduces, along with this finding from the archive. So you see, what Schleich suggests already happened back in 1892, and is in the public domain. And you could also see, therefore, that we are passing each other by like ships in the night, talking past each other. We can see this quite objectively, and it is because, unfortunately, there is no self-evident meeting place in these different areas of research and publication, no clearly recognized need for such encounter. Here we have a very striking example of this, in which someone with the best will in the world and with the necessary brilliance arrives at the idea that such a thing might exist, and yet it has already been available for over 20 years. This is very interesting, isn't it, in relation to the whole way in which science and spiritual science interact. We can learn a great deal from it, especially when we are sure that no spark of bad will underlies it, but that the research in question is being undertaken with absolute authenticity and integrity. But at the same time, you can also see that what spiritual science undertakes is truly not capricious, but is founded on a perception of the inner necessity at work in humanity's spiritual evolution. And this spiritual course of humanity's evolution really does tell us that a certain sum of spiritual insights must stream into humankind and be shaped in a way that succors humanity. In this respect, our time is ready for many things, and we must not overlook the fact, now that the spilling of blood heralds the dawn of a new age, when so many souls are speaking to us after they have passed as our time's sacrifices through the gate of death, that the world of spirit is knocking at the gates that lead from it to our world. The call for spirit today must not go unheard, for the spirit is coming and announces itself in all kinds of ways. This spirit need only be directed in the proper channels. But here it has to be said that those who seek to walk on such paths will not always meet with their proper due. When we endeavor to introduce the spiritual world in a way really born upon a scientific approach, this certainly is not met by the cymbals and flutes of the modern equivalents of priests and Levites, but instead encounters all sorts of opposition, sometimes of an objectionable kind. One need only consider the whole significance underlying this fact. On the one hand, we have efforts founded on scientific rigor to convey to humanity the revelations of the world of spirit. These efforts are met, as they invariably are, by those whose opposition is already familiar to us, through to very clever-seeming characters, such as Thassilo von Scheffer, people who respond to our efforts with vacuous phrases. But on the other hand, we see certain truths of the spiritual world flooding in through the channels possible today. I am thinking not just of Strindberg's important title Dream Play, which we can regard certainly as an influx of the spiritual world, in which much can be recognized and acknowledged, but also of lesser and less important types of influx of the spiritual world into our physical world. For instance, there is a modern writer who is very popular today, partly because he can really be of interest to people, since he gains extraordinary access to the world of spirit. Much streams into him that is greatly distorted, caricatured, but, therefore, becomes all the more interesting, perhaps, to modern readers. And by this means he can exert a popular influence, for he describes futuristic scenarios, not as painter, but as writer. If you read, titled Golem, by Gustav Meyrink, you can say that a hugely powerful current of spiritual life is breaking in here, but in distorted, caricatured forms, in which it can do more harm than good for those who are not solid in themselves. But this is a phenomenon of our times, too. A living current is breaking in from the world of spirit, apparent, for instance, in the excellent short story Cardinal Napolis. Especially here, you can discern the author's insights and perceptions of the distinctive workings of the Akashic records and such like, wonderfully conveyed. This is described, in fact, without any of the wild runaway futurism that we see in title Golem. Here you do really find that the world of spirit is seeking entry, and a great many such phenomena can be discerned today. The seriousness to which we are now so strongly prompted includes gaining an understanding of the importance of opening our heart, soul, and head to the currents entering from the world of spirit. And then, as I have often said, we can meet the grave circumstances of our times through spiritual scientific endeavors, accomplishing what it is essential to accomplish. And here at the end is a verse from Steiner, quote, "From the courage of fighters, from the blood of slaughter, from the suffering of the bereaved, from the people's deeds of sacrifice, spirit fruit will grow, so that souls with spirit awareness may guide their mind into the spirit realm." Close quote. The end of Lecture 5.